This is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, U.S. Republican presidential contender Donald Trump continues to defy his critics. Thousands of African and Middle Eastern migrants keep heading for Europe. Scientists push hard to freeze DNA before species go extinct. A new hip-hop musical highlights an American founding father.
I just thought Hamilton's life story contains multitudes, particularly in the way Ron unlocked it, in the way that Hamilton is sort of the proto-American immigrant story.
These stories and more just ahead. I'm Ray Kugel. U.S. billionaire real estate tycoon and Republican presidential contender Donald Trump appears to be surviving the latest backlash to an election campaign marked by sharp personal attacks on his critics. A Reuters Ipsos poll released on Monday suggests he has the backing of 24% of Republican voters. That's double his nearest rival, former Florida Governor Jeb Bush, who was at 12%. The poll was conducted after last week's Republican presidential debate that sparked a feud between Trump and female television anchor Megyn Kelly, one of the debate moderators. Trump made comments about Kelly both during and after the debate that many Americans perceived to be sexist, although he later denied that he had any such intention. International Edition's Michael Lippin spoke with VOA national correspondent Jim Malone about how Trump's Republican rivals have been responding to his remarks about Kelly.
That's really interesting. Remember, we have a total of 17 Republican contenders at the moment. A few have stood up and criticized Donald Trump in the wake of some of his comments about women, different things. Former Florida Governor Jeb Bush, Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker, former CEO Carly Fiorina has also been critical of Trump and his comments about women. But some of the other candidates have been deciding to sort of take a pass on it. They may not think the comments were particularly nice, but they're not going to be directly critical. I'm thinking of people like Senator Ted Cruz of Texas. Ohio Governor John Kasich, for example, said in the debate that Trump has tapped into something in the country, an anger and frustration, something he understands that's going on. So it's a real mixed bag right now. And I think this goes to the idea that a lot of the rivals of Trump don't really know how to approach him right now. They don't know how to handle him. They're going to be watching the polls very closely as well. Let's be honest, too. Some of them would love to have that support he has right now. So they want to be careful what they say about him so that they don't hurt their chances of winning over those voters down the line should Trump sort of self-destruct.
What opportunities do the Republicans have in the coming days and weeks to try to get their messages out to more voters?
This debate got a huge audience, 24 million, largest primary debate of all time, really, in terms of television ratings. So, yes, they tuned in for Trump, but they got to see other people like John Kasich, Senator Marco Rubio of Florida, earlier Carly Fiorina. So, in a way, Trump's presence there caused a lot of interest, but is an opportunity for some of his rivals to get noticed. The next debate is going to be in mid-September. The Republicans have fewer debates this time because they felt in 2012 there were too many and their candidates got caught up and, you know, were not able to build on public support. There will be some smaller events in between, but certainly what we're starting to sense is these debates are going to be a huge defining moment in the campaign, as this last one was. So a lot of them are already going to be planning for the next debate in mid-September in California.
Is there any intensification of the election rivalry on the Democratic side? They don't have a debate for a while until October, I think. But, for example, Joe Biden, there's been a lot of talk of him possibly getting in. What do we know about that?
Well, we just know that I just got an email in the inbox from the Draft Biden Group, which is supposedly not operating with his, you know, sort of say-so or permission, but they're adding staff people. They're trying to gear up. So the effort to try to convince Joe Biden to get in the race is intensifying, if anything. But we're hearing nothing from him that suggests that he's made a decision one way or the other that could come in the next several weeks, perhaps, and we hope to hear something. But Bernie Sanders continues to draw large crowds. though a very interesting thing happened in Seattle where some black activists took over the stage at a downtown rally and kind of forced him to close out the rally. So the whole Hillary Clinton, Bernie Sanders, what's going to happen on the Democratic side? She's looking a little vulnerable right now. Democrats are getting excited about making a challenge, but the question still remains, can any of the Democratic challengers really beat her?
National correspondent Jim Malone speaking with International Edition's Michael Lippin. Time now to check out what's trending on social media. For today's segment, International Edition's G. Abby Lee takes a look at how the Republican presidential contenders are doing since last week's big debate. Welcome, G.
Hello, Ray. As you mentioned earlier, the latest poll shows that Donald Trump is still leading the Republican presidential race. CNBC Now tweeted those figures earlier Monday, stating that the margin of error is 6.7%. That's been shared around 1,000 times, and of course, Trump himself retweeted that.
Well, that's no surprise.
Mm-hmm.
Gee, that's a pretty significant gap between Trump and Bush.
Absolutely. Jeb Bush is definitely one of the perceived losers from Thursday's debate, which might explain why he hasn't tweeted about it. His Twitter handle is @JebBush.
So, besides Trump, who else is considered to have benefited from last week's debate?
Definitely Carly Fiorina. She's a former CEO of Hewlett-Packard and on Twitter @CarlyFiorina. That's F-I-O-R-I-N-A. A day after the debate, she tweeted, @GOPDebate, I won over our largest audience yet. Another contender who is happy with how the debate unfolded is Ben Carson. He's a retired neurosurgeon and the only African-American contender from the Republican side. Megyn Kelly with Fox News, who moderated the debate, tweeted Carson was very pleased with his performance during the event. He's on Twitter @RealBenCarson. Ray?
Thanks for the update, G. Social media reporter G. Abby Lee, and you can follow her on Twitter @GAbbyLee. That's JEEABBEYLEE. And you can also comment on our website at www.voanews.com. This is VOA.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
Hi, I'm Larry London, and I'm the host of Border Crossings, inviting you to join me for one of the best hours of request music possible on the radio. We've got all your favorite songs by your favorite singers. You tell us what to play. It's requests and dedications, and it happens every weekday right here on The Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. Thousands of migrants have arrived at the French port of Calais. They're trying to reach Britain through the Channel Tunnel and the trains that use it. One Sudanese man actually walked the full 50 kilometers through the tunnel and was arrested on the other end in Kent, England. Itai Viriri is a spokesman for the International Organization for Migration. International Edition's Jeffrey Young spoke with him about why Calais is attracting so many migrants and why they take such risks to get there.
For a start, quite a lot of migrants who try to make this journey usually have some family ties in the UK. And they also have ties maybe in terms of language, so some of them speak English, or just have the familiarity of what they think the UK represents in terms of their future prospects.
But at the same time, you're not going to get any benefits just by walking into Britain through the tunnel. They're not going to just hand you things. So if you have no documentation, the British government's not going to help you, correct? So that doesn't really help them, does it?
That is correct in that, you know, the British government does not give benefits to new arrivals. In fact, I think they have very strict rules concerning that. But what usually happens with people who make this kind of journey, you know, people who get up and go and migrate, they usually want to work for themselves. They want to provide for their families, and they really are there to search for jobs. Right now, the UK, out of all the economies in Western Europe, is one of the really successful economies, which has had a very good turnaround from the recent recession. So that certainly filters down to all the migrants in terms of having the knowledge as to where the jobs are to be found. So you find that the majority, I'll say the vast majority of these migrants actually just want to work and be very productive and active workers in the countries that they are hoping to reach.
Among the thousands of people who have massed in Calais, can you give me an idea as to where some of these people came from, where the migration came from?
Well, the majority of them come from countries like Eritrea, Ethiopia, Sudan, Afghanistan, and obviously we usually have Syrians. As you know, quite a lot of Syrians have been leaving the country or their region trying to look for, you know, better opportunities abroad. So these are usually the nationalities that are to be found at Calais right now.
I also see from reading reports about this that this is creating friction between France and Britain. In fact, I see in one report the French Interior Minister has said that Britain must, in his words, go further in mobilizing resources to resolve the situation. What about France itself? What is France doing to help these people?
Well, what usually happens when people go to this locality in Calais that we're talking about is that there is a day center that is usually open that provides some sort of support for the migrants who are there right now. But it only operates during the day. So at night, the migrants have to fend for themselves. But what I can add to that is that the International Organization for Migration has been consistently calling on the European Union to show some solidarity in terms of assisting these migrants. Right now, we see a situation whereby this union is not actually acting in unison. You see countries reacting differently to this migration crisis. We see a situation where Italy and Greece are getting an overwhelming number of migrants. In fact, between the two of them, they have almost 200,000. And yet, there doesn't seem to be that much broader support from the rest of the EU. So we're saying that there should be more burden sharing. They should be able to share the numbers across the board. But that's not happening right now.
Itai Viriri, spokesperson for the International Organization for Migration in Geneva, speaking with International Edition's Jeffrey Young. Turning now to business news, Chinese stocks had a great start to the week, posting their biggest rally in a month on Monday. Business correspondent Alexis Christophers in New York has more on what's behind the Chinese market rebound.
We had data over the weekend that showed producer prices in China fell last month to a six-year low. Exports dropped more than expected, but that wasn't enough to get the markets down. It looks like traders are betting the Chinese government will accelerate mergers of state-owned enterprises, or SOEs, to help boost economic growth. We saw the Shanghai Composite Index jump nearly 5% to 39.28, led by industrial, energy, and telecom companies. China Shipbuilding, China Coal Energy, and China United Network Communications all surged by their 10% daily limit. And there are reports that China is considering combining its two major shipping companies, China Shipping Group and Costco Group. So that anticipation of more reform among the SOEs in China is really helping to boost the stock market, at least in the short term.
The price of oil is still down. Again, reporter Christophorus.
We did see a nice pop in crude oil in the most recent session. It was up about 2%, approaching $45 a barrel. However, there is still more downside pressure. And one well-known oil analyst, John Kilduff, believes that oil will probably bottom out in the low 30s by September or October. Saudi Arabia continues to produce a lot of oil, hurting non-OPEC producers. And at some point, ExxonMobil, Chevron, and ConocoPhillips will be buys. But for right now, analyst Kilduff says he's standing on the sidelines because he thinks there's more downside pressure for oil overall.
Business correspondent Alexis Christophorus in our New York bureau. Alcoholics and drug abusers have to contend with serious addictions. There's now something else for them to worry about. They could be suffering from the very foods they eat, but there could be a solution. Dr. Keith Cantor is a nutritionist based in the southern U.S. city of Atlanta, Georgia. International Edition Susan Yaki spoke with him about how nutrition and addictions are linked.
I think most of the addiction centers and rehabilitation centers are doing a great job, but they're missing the link, and here's what it is. To be addicted to a substance, you know, drugs, alcohol, is all related to our opiate receptors, which are clusters of proteins that are in our brain, our spinal cord, and our gastrointestinal tract. And research shows that people that are addicted to these substances have stimulated opiate receptors. When the opiate receptors are stimulated, they release chemicals that give the body urges. If you're addicted to a substance, the urge that they give you is to have more of that substance. So I started studying that more and more, and I found that a lot of several different foods have the same effect on the opiate receptors. Sugar being a big one, gluten being another big one, certain milk byproducts, caffeine, nicotine, some dyes and preservatives. And what they do is they stimulate the opiate receptors. The opiate receptors releases the different chemicals that give the body the urges. Our body can't really distinguish what the urges are for, so it's whatever you're addicted to.
So should patients take more sugar, more nicotine, or should they stay away from those things?
They have to stay away from those things. So what the NAME program did is we developed menus for 5 meals a day, 3 meals and 2 snacks, for 365 days a year, for the clinics and rehabilitation centers, because it really only works in a controlled environment, because they still need things like counseling, which is very important, what started them to want it to begin with. If you go to nameprogram.com, I have a week's worth of menus there. And if you go to DR for Dr. KeithCantor.com, you could find lots of healthy menus, but they may not be related to what's needed for the addiction, but just regular healthy menus. If they're in a controlled environment and they're getting counseling and they're getting exercise and they're getting some relaxation and all the other parts of that the addiction centers and rehabilitations do, it gives them less urges and it increases the successful withdrawal rate from the drug. And then I allow the patients through the clinics, they have a code so they could get the menus. I allow them to give it to the patients when they leave, so those that are willing to could follow up and keep using the different menus so they don't stimulate the opiate receptors and therefore have a lower relapse rate.
That's very interesting, and it could change people's lives.
Yes, it could change their lives, and it's nothing really extra for the addiction clinics. It's just minor changes to the menus and the beverages that they drink, but it'll definitely increase the successful withdrawal rate and lower the relapse rate of the recovering alcoholics. So we're real excited about the program, and so far it looks like the clinics that are taking on the program seem very happy with it.
Nutritionist Dr. Keith Cantor, that's spelled K-A-N-T-O-R, speaking with my colleague Susan Yaki. Coming up, hip-hop comes to Broadway with a smash hit. This is VOA.
This is Greenbee for a healthier planet.
The disappearance of forests leads to erosion, soil degradation, and other environmental problems. But much of what has been lost may be regained simply by planting trees. John Leary is the executive director of Trees for the Future.
Planting trees is a real critical anchor in the community, and it's kind of a real essential thing to return tree cover to the degraded lands.
Leary says they have planted more than 100 million trees since their inception about 25 years ago, and they are especially focused on sub-Saharan Africa.
And we guide farmers through the process of planting fast-growing and thorny trees that help revitalize and stabilize fields.
Last year, Trees for the Future put more than 20 million trees into the ground.
Really trying to help 4,000 families plant their way out of poverty.
The plan, says Leary, is to grow the program to reach 10,000 families in the next few years. I'm Rebecca Ward for VOA's Green Beat.
This is VOA's International Edition coming to you from Washington. Earth is in the midst of its sixth extinction. The last such event was caused by an asteroid 66 million years ago. It killed off the dinosaurs and practically everything else. Scientists are now in a race against time to classify the estimated 11 million species alive today. So far, only 2 million are described by science, and researchers are worried many will disappear before they even have a name. VOA's Roseanne Scherbel reports a field project at the U.S. Botanic Garden in Washington is trying to help.
The effort is part of the Global Genome Initiative. Smithsonian senior research botanist Vicky Funk says it's a big job, but the Botanic Garden is a great place to start.
Because if you look around you, you see all kinds of plants from all over the world growing right next to one another. And so instead of having to go to Madagascar to get a plant and Hawaii to get a plant, you can get them in rooms that are adjacent to one another.
Today is a test run for a procedure that will be put in place worldwide at 36 partner institutions in 17 countries. First, Funk photographs a long-stem pink flower called Sabathia. She puts one snippet into silica gel and drops another into liquid nitrogen, where it's frozen. Next, she clips the blossom and presses it in a plant book for a museum collection.
The plants are placed between these corrugates that have holes in them, and when we get the press back, we put it into a dryer that blows hot air through it, and overnight it'll turn it into a beautiful specimen. Usually it saves the color. It looks very nice.
All the samples are numbered and linked in a database with the frozen specimens, which are sent to the Smithsonian's Genomics Laboratory for DNA analysis. Jonathan Connington directs the Genome Initiative at the Museum of Natural History. He says the project is on target to gather samples from all 10,000 plant and animal families and half the genera in those families within 5 years.
Just into our biorepository, in the pipeline, I have over 2,000 families and close to 12,000 genera.
Coddington says that biorepository at another Washington location is the largest such facility in the world.
What we want to do is organize it and get a lot of information evenly spaced out across all of life, from bacteria to humans.
That means a lot of science can get done across many disciplines, says Kristen Van Ness, one of the college students helping with the project at the Botanic Garden.
What we're doing is important because it's not just for our use, it's for future use.
And with plans for a career in conservation ecology, Van Ness is excited to be part of work that scientists will use to identify species, solve ecosystem problems, monitor effects of climate change, and look for new cures for diseases. Roseanne Scherbel, VOA News, Washington.
While the Republicans were holding their first U.S. presidential debate on television last week, the country's founding fathers are holding their own debates at the same time on Broadway, with the opening of a new hip-hop musical called Hamilton. There's a lot of positive buzz about the show since it opened last winter off-Broadway, where it had a sold-out run. VOA's Jeff London has more.
Lin-Manuel Miranda has been working on Hamilton for 6 years. It started with him sitting on a beach, reading Ron Chernow's 832-page biography of the country's first Treasury Secretary, and realizing the story sang to him.
I feel like a mosquito that hit an artery. That's how I felt when I read Ron Chernow's book. I just thought, Hamilton's life story contains multitudes, particularly in the way Ron unlocked it, in the way that Hamilton is sort of the proto-American immigrant story, the trauma of his early years, and how that kind of created a crack in the foundation.
Biographer Chernow says he was initially skeptical that his book could be turned into a musical, much less one that uses rap as its main source of expression. But he agreed to meet with Miranda.
He came over to my house. He sat on my living room couch. He started snapping his fingers, and he sang the opening song. And I absolutely marveled at what he'd done, because I realized that he had condensed the first 40 pages of my book accurately into a 4.5-minute song.
Miranda performed that opening number at a poetry evening at the White House in 2009.
The $10 founding father without a father got a lot farther by working a lot harder, by being a lot smarter, by being a self-starter. By 14, they placed him in charge of the trade and charter.
Hamilton's life really was like a Dickensian novel, filled with coincidence and reversals of fortune. He brought himself out of poverty, immigrated to New York, and became a leading figure in the American Revolution as an aide to George Washington. He wrote most of the Federalist Papers, created the National Bank, was involved in the first national sex scandal, and managed to create enemies from Thomas Jefferson and James Madison to Aaron Burr, who famously killed Hamilton in a duel.
The fights we had then in the formation of our country will be the fights we have 100 years from now, 200 years from now. They will be, what is the role of the state versus the role of the larger country? What is our responsibility to other countries that are not our own? The two battles, cabinet battles in our show, are about those two things, because they're going to outlive us. We'll always be having those fights.
In telling this story from over 200 years ago, Miranda and his director, Thomas Kail, made the decision to have the show performed by a multiracial, multi-ethnic cast.
Tommy's goal was to eliminate any distance between a contemporary audience and this story. That's what the music aims to do. That's what the entire production aims to do. And so it's a story of America then told by what America looks like now.
I wanna be in the room where it happens, the room where it happens.
One of the repeated lines in Hamilton is, who lives, who dies, who tells your story? And Lin-Manuel Miranda wants to make sure that this story is told by as many different people as possible once the run on Broadway is done years from now.
When this is done as the school play, it opens up the show to the entire school. And that's something I'm really excited about.
Critics and audiences are already excited. The show received rave reviews on its Broadway opening, and the box office now tops $32 million. For VOA News, I'm Jeff London in New York.
That's it for this edition of International Edition. You can get more news and information on our website at voanews.com. Thank you for joining us. I'm Ray Kugel in Washington. Enjoy the day.
Next, an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.
50 years ago this month, American democracy was born anew with the signing into law of the U.S. Voting Rights Act. Forged in the crucible of the civil rights movement of the 1950s and 60s, when black Americans and other minorities organized to end decades of discrimination against them, the law both reaffirmed their basic rights as citizens and revolutionized our political system. The act, signed by President Lyndon Johnson on August 6, 1965, affirmed blacks and other minorities' right to vote, a right that came with the fall of slavery a century earlier, but was often denied by political means. It struck down many procedures used in various cities and states to maintain white political control by limiting the votes of minorities. These included requirements that voters pay a tax to cast a ballot and be able to prove that they could read and write. It also provided federal oversight of elections where black voter registration was low, and it empowered the Attorney General to investigate other tactics used to suppress the vote. Almost overnight, black voter registration grew exponentially, most markedly in the South, where discrimination had been most pronounced. Since then, Congress has followed up by adding amendments several times, most notably by requiring bilingual elections, thus enfranchising foreign speakers as well as racial minorities. In the years to follow, our political leadership, from city halls to state houses to the U.S. Capitol and the White House, grew more diverse. By the mid-1990s, these moves and the broadening of the U.S. electorate they fostered had culminated in an almost complete realignment of our two major political parties. As the nation celebrates the 50th anniversary of the Voting Rights Act and the great strides we've taken as a nation since, we also remember those who worked to make the law and its ideals a reality, securing for all the full blessings and privileges of American life.
That was an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.